good morning to both the Facebook and Zoom audiences. We're very thankful for you to be here and be part of this discussion. My name is Karan Pohl. I'm the president of the Locke Johnson Society, as well as a student of economics and international affairs at the University of Georgia. We're joined by Dr. Richard Winfield, who is a distinguished research professor of philosophy at the university, having taught since 1982. Throughout his career, he has published innumerable works on the topics of philosophy, labor, religion, and much more, describing himself as a husband, father, educator, and a union member. Today, Richard fights for social and economic rights in the pursuit of justice, knowing from personal experience the deep value of public service and the struggles of the American worker, having run for the 10th district in the U.S. House of Representatives on these platforms. Currently, Richard is running for the United States Senate in a special election against Kelly Loeffler, advocating for a social bill of rights anchored in a federal job guarantee. You can learn more about his platform at winfieldforsenate.com. And finally, we have a special guest, Dr. Shashi Tharoor from India. Dr. Tharoor has a storied career as a politician, writer, and diplomat, having served as the Undersecretary General for the United Nations and written numerous books. Dr. Tharoor has worked towards peacekeeping and diplomatic efforts around the world. As a studied scholar of Indian history, culture, economics, and foreign policy, Dr. Tharoor has authored numerous books while being featured in hundreds of articles, op-eds, and book reviews. Today, he continues his work as a member of Parliament in Lok Sabha and as chairman of the Parliamentary Standing Committee on External Affairs. You can learn more about Dr. Tharoor at his website, shashitharoor.in. Thank you both, gentlemen, for being here today. And I really appreciate this opportunity to discuss globalization and unemployment with the two of you.
Okay.
So.
Glad to be with you. Yeah, and thank you for participating in this event. I have to say, I think it's
my pleasure.
I think it's evident to all of us, whether in the United States or India, that our lives, livelihoods, and freedoms are very much in peril. And that the problems we're facing are not just domestic in character, they have a global dimension, and the solutions also call for something that goes beyond what we can do simply within our own borders. And I think you are uniquely in a position to think about the problems and their remedies, given your deep experience in the United Nations and in domestic politics. And I'm looking forward to see how you diagnose the threats we're facing as well as what kind of solutions we can enact.
Well, it certainly is a very challenging time, Richard. I've been looking at your platform and I'm very impressed that you have this social agenda that talks about federal jobs guaranteed, healthcare for all, worker empowerment and collective bargaining, work-family balance through paid family leave and child and elder care and so on. And of course, legal support for people to be represented. Now, in these circumstances, I'm curious, the first and most obvious question that people will ask you is, can the US afford all of this? I think in India, we would love to have these things and there'd be probably much more political support for these five elements in India. But we also know at the moment we don't have the resources for it in a country of 1.3 billion people. The US has fewer people to take care of this way, but can you raise the resources for this, Richard?
I mean, I think that when we're speaking about social rights or rights in general, these are matters that I think can actually be implemented in any nation, irrespective of the kind of resources it has at its disposal, because we're not talking about specific results. We're talking about rather opportunities and that the opportunities be fair. So obviously what a fair minimum wage will be in a nation depends upon its productivity. What will be the level of healthcare to which everyone will have access will depend upon the resources of a nation. What kind of housing people can have access to will likewise depend upon, in a sense, the degree of wealth and production of wealth, et cetera. So I think that there is a way of thinking about these matters as much in India as in the United States. And I think in both nations, when you ask, how can we fund these matters? I think first of all, one wants to get away from this notion that we have to pay as you go. The idea that gets kind of put into a very rigid form by those who want to say, we have to have a balanced budget. You know, we can never enlarge our money supply or rely on deficit spending as a way of financing the measures that need to be taken. I think it's important to recognize, to the extent that both the United States and India have a fiat money system where our money is not pegged to a particular commodity or to an another currency, you know, we have fiscal freedom to basically put money out there to spend. And of course, that money will retain its value only insofar as there are goods and services to buy. And we use it in a way that promotes our productivity. And then, of course, we may be concerned with using taxation as a way of funding much or all of it, and do so in a way that serves the purpose of not allowing great accumulation of wealth to sit at the very top, where they're not really being productively invested, but distributed more evenly. So I think in the case of the United States, you know, doing the calculations, all of the extra expenses of this social rights agenda could easily be accommodated by a wealth tax on the top 1% and down to the top 10%. And
I you certainly have a, you certainly have a large number of billionaires in the US. We're developing our own little coterie of those, but what you've got would probably pay a lot more than, but of course the numbers one hears bandied about, that just a federal jobs guarantee would cost $700 to $800 billion and so on. I'm sure you can dispute all that. But the question is indeed, how many people, what minimum wage you will offer and so on. And there is the argument that it could contribute to inflation by raising the cost of labor. And the argument that there'd also be a mismatch between the skills the economy needs and the skills of people who want jobs are offering. So, you know, in India, we've got the scheme named for Mahatma Gandhi, which guarantees a job for one person from a family living below the poverty line in every Indian village for 100 days. And the wage is essentially minimum wage, slightly over, but not much in most Indian states. But the problem is that in many cases, it is very simple manual labor that's offered. Many of the Americans who've been looking for work are far more qualified than many of the Indians in the National Rural Employment Guarantee Scheme. So when these kinds of practical concerns are raised against a federal jobs guarantee, I'm sure you've thought about this and have responses. How would you address both the fear of inflation and the skilling mismatch? Yeah.
I mean, first of all, with regard to the issue of inflation, a federal job guarantee has a kind of stabilizing effect, a counter-cyclical effect, in that essentially you're going to be expanding the numbers of people who will be offered jobs when you're in recession or depression. And that, in a sense, will put more income into the economy and resist the kind of deflationary pressures that operate under those circumstances. When, thanks to, in a sense, achieving full employment and all that that provides in sort of ensuring a kind of full consumer purchase power that remains relatively stable, the economy can rebound, and then you can contract the amount of people who will have to rely upon the federal job guarantee. Instead of having employers depend upon a reserve army of the unemployed, you have a reserve army of the employed. But then that will come back. There will be less government spending. So that will act in a way against inflation. And of course, one has to recognize that you're going to try to put people to work, not in things that are already being handled by the private sector, which would only increase unemployment and overproduction. You're going to have them attend to things that we do need, but are not being dealt with. And I think if you take the example of what went on in the United States during the Great Depression, on a large scale, probably not big enough a scale, it enlisted people of all sorts of aptitudes and talents, including writers in the Federal Writers Project, including artists, performers of all sorts, people of all sorts of technical expertise. And of course, in a modern economy, you know, manufacturing in the United States only takes up 8% of breadwinners. Agricultural work involves only 1.7% of the population. And that does not mean that agricultural or industrial production has declined. It hasn't. But most of the workforce is working in the service sector. And that means jobs that have a human touch, jobs that are robot-proof, that can use people of all sorts of aptitudes. And I think the same thing will apply more and more in India. I mean, the program you referred to obviously just deals with the rural population for part of the time. But one can think of it as extending, generally speaking, throughout the country. And then think about all the various things that the community would need. I think we know that everything in the public sphere is, in many respects, very underfunded.
And well, I mean, a lot of work. No, jobs are the absolute right thing to hit on. I don't know. I mean, you're running in Georgia, what the situation in Georgia is. Here in India, in 3 months over the summer, we lost 21 million white-collar jobs. So people working in offices, people working in industries, people working in services, who essentially either saw themselves fired or their employers shrugged and said, we're not making any money, we can't pay you. So essentially, they're out of a job. Now, these circumstances are colossally negative here. I'm assuming that in Georgia, even as a proportion of the workforce, things are not as bad. Obviously, you probably don't have 21 million people in Georgia working to begin with, but whatever percentage of the working force has lost jobs must be smaller. To what degree is this a big political issue in your Senate race?
Well, I think, you know, we're in a situation where because the pandemic was not properly contained, there was no choice but to have a large shutdown of much, not all, but much of the economy, which led to massive job losses beyond anything in the Great Depression. Now there's been a significant amount of reopening, not necessarily done safely, because the pandemic has not been contained. The number of cases is again increasing, and the number of deaths will increase as well per day. But as a result, there are still a degree of unemployment we haven't seen it, at least in my lifetime, and a tremendous amount of economic stress. And what our nation did not do, which certain other nations did do, who did not contain the pandemic and had to shut down large parts of their economy, we did not provide payroll protection as other nations did, where they provided funding to employers to keep people on payroll, even if they could not actually work entirely. And I think that's something that was not done in the United States properly and caused a tremendous amount of distress. You know, they're estimated a third of the population could not pay the rent or mortgage payments this summer. There are vastly larger numbers of people who are euphemistically spoken of as being food insecure. That is to say, they don't have the money to feed themselves. And that's to a degree we haven't seen. And this needs to be addressed, obviously. And I, obviously, when Modi shut down India with very little notice, without providing, I think, the kind of backup to keep people solvent.
Yep.
You know, this not only did not prevent the pandemic from being contained, since all of these, you know,
people had to go back home.
Yeah. Had to go back home, spread everything everywhere else. And, you know, it, obviously it's a very challenging situation. But there are two prerogatives. You have to keep people solvent, and you have to take the measures to keep things as safe as possible.
Your campaign platform sort of looks very much like a European one. I was interested that the Europeans, after some weeks of bitter disagreement between the countries in economic trouble that were first hit by the coronavirus and the so-called frugal four of Northern Europe, they finally came around to agreeing on a €750 billion fund to provide fiscal stimulus and security to the economy. And the Europeans seem to be facing the world with much more confidence after that. Do you have fiscal stimulus coming out of Washington? And are you seeing the benefits of any of that in Georgia? And in what form is that happening?
Well, as you probably know, there was a large fiscal stimulus adopted by Congress, the so-called CARE Act, which was of an unprecedented size. It was, I think it gave guarantees of up to $4 trillion. Much of those guarantees to industry, and they were not necessarily tied to keeping people on payroll. Oddly enough, they gave support to small business, provided they kept people on payroll, but 82% of small businesses in the US have no employees. And among African-American entrepreneurs, it's 95% have no employees. So they were left out in the cold, whereas large business received funding, but they didn't have to put people back to work. So on the other hand, they gave significantly increased unemployment benefits to people, but not everyone got them. So there was an effort to inject, without having tax revenues to cover it, a large amount of economic activity. Now things are stalled. Trump is resisting any kind of negotiations. The Republican Party doesn't want to continue this kind of care package at the same level. It's incomplete. There has been extended a ban on evictions and foreclosures put forward by the CDC as a matter of health. And obviously you can't shelter in place if you're homeless. But I think we're really facing a cliff where the support is not being given. And many, many people are hurting very badly.
Right, okay. Well, I must say that that this is a tough situation all around. And maybe we should just move aside briefly from economics, because what the rest of us and the rest of the world have been seeing in the US is this extraordinary conversation taking place in your society on the issue of civil rights and the treatment of racial and ethnic minorities in particular, the whole Black Lives Matter movement, the resurgence of young people on the streets, the cases of George Floyd, of Breonna Taylor, and the reaction of the present administration. Can you tell us, is this issue playing out in a big way during the course of your upcoming election? And when you talk about economic justice, where do you stand on issues of social justice, racial justice, police reforms, defunding the police, all of those issues? How are they playing with your electors in Georgia?
Well, I think one can speak of what can be considered the unfinished business of the civil rights movement. Because in the late 60s, there was a success in having legislation adopted, thanks to the civil rights struggle spearheaded by Martin Luther King, to eliminate legal discrimination of all sorts. And the women's movement and the gay rights movement has achieved similar results. But what has not been eliminated is the abiding social disadvantage, which in a way is encapsulated in the abiding wealth and income gap between Black and white and between women and men. And what I think is significant about our situation in the US compared to India is our constitution does not involve any recognition of the social rights that were adopted in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which includes the right to a job, the right to healthcare, right to education at all levels, and a right to culture and so forth. This is not part of the American constitution. I believe it is part of the mammoth Indian constitution, and the constitutions of pretty much all nations who came to independence after the Second World War. But we don't have that. But I think the crux of what the Black Lives Matter movement really revolves around is tackling this abiding social disadvantage, of which police violence against people of color is really the tip of the iceberg, which reflects the disproportionate impoverishment. And in the United States, as in many other countries, not every country, your access to all the other factors you need depends upon how much wealth and income you have. And that's true of healthcare in the United States, which is not true in many other countries, where, you know, we have this shocking longevity gap of 20 years between people who are poor and people who are rich. There's no need for something like that. So I think the crux of my campaign is about raising the need to address these neglected social rights. I think in India, you have a constitutional framework where they are already recognized and expressed. The question is, are they fulfilled? Are the public investments being made to enable these rights, which are there on paper?
Right. I mean, they are on paper there in India. They're not always well fulfilled. And we have our own challenges of social stratification, of marginalized communities, minorities, lower castes. We have our own challenges. Which I'm sure there are points of reflection. I was struck by Isabel Wilkerson's recent book about the disabilities suffered by Blacks in America through the prism of the notion of caste as a fixed and immutable identity, and with parallels to caste disabilities in India as well. So I think there's an increasing consciousness of what you're talking about there, and I would agree with that. Can we turn to COVID itself and how the administration has been handling the pandemic? Because we've seen the president and his quite extraordinary response to his own illness and his return to the White House, where he's possibly infected all the staff he's been dealing with. It's been quite remarkable. And I must say, quite a contrast to the way in which we in India have been encouraged to keep ourselves healthy and safe and distant and so on. Mind you, in India, not very many not very many people observe these restrictions, but certainly those in the position to set a public example do, unlike in your country. But I'm just curious as to whether you have thoughts on the overall handling of the pandemic. I recognize in your country, for example, that the states make crucial decisions. State governor has a bigger role than an Indian chief minister, because in India, the home ministry can issue directives on lockdowns and unlocking and various kinds of restrictions that apply throughout the country, invoking a little known provision of our Disaster Management Act. Yeah. Whereas in America, you can't ride roughshod over the rights of the states the way you can in India. So one can't entirely credit or blame the administration in Washington, D.C. for the way in which the pandemic has been dealt with. And you in Georgia, I'm sure, have your own local issues to deal with coming out of your governor and local policies. But could you share a little bit about how you see the handling of the pandemic in America and in Georgia? And whether, for example, ethnic minorities have been more disproportionately affected by the pandemic and its handling, economically, socially, and other ways?
Well, you know, it's also come out recently with the book by Woodward, with his interviews of Trump, you know, that our government did know of the magnitude of the threat of COVID early on, back in January. But it did not take any real decisive measures to begin mobilizing production of testing, of PPEs, and of any kind of preventive measures to contain the spread. And that has continued throughout, and which is why, you know, we've become the number one country in terms of the number of infections, the number of deaths. And there's no end in sight under this administration. And that has been compounded by local leaders. Our governor in Georgia, his name is Kemp, is notorious for trying to resist any efforts by local municipalities to impose any kind of restrictions on gatherings, on the openings of indoor establishments, on wearing masks and the like. He has done everything he can to nullify those results, and he's shown complete ignorance in terms of how the disease itself is spread. And I think that is a huge problem. And unfortunately, large parts of our population, particularly in a state like Georgia, are ignoring minimal precautions. And now here in Athens, which is a big university town, we're becoming a hotspot, as are many other university towns, because universities are reopening in many respects in person. And I'm afraid the young people feel fairly vulnerable. If you go to Athens, the bars are packed with students with no precautions. And the number of infections is growing, and it's spreading to the local population. Whereas meanwhile, our schools are grappling with how to reopen. And they've decided in our local public schools not to reopen in person, but to rely on remote learning. But that's a problem then for the poverty of our population, which is disproportionately people of color, who don't have access to broadband, who don't have access to affordable childcare. I mean, if they're working, how do they deal with children who are now at home? And as you suggested, the toll in terms of both death and destitution among our minorities is much, much higher. And it reflects the way in which poverty itself is a pre-existing condition that makes you vulnerable to COVID. You're not getting proper nutrition. You have much higher rates of obesity, diabetics, and not having access to proper medical care, having a much higher share in the homeless population, you're simply not able to protect yourself. And you're also more highly employed in those service essential industries where you have been in work all along, been in contact in the healthcare providing industry with people who are infected. And the toll is very, very significantly higher among African Americans and Hispanics. And we're not seeing that abating.
I guess I should come. Sorry, to finish. I thought, go please.
I actually had no, absolutely. Yes, I wanted to bring up a point that we discussed earlier. We mentioned the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And the question I think comes to how do we determine these social and economic rights? Is it the role of international organizations? To what extent can they actually dictate how individual countries aspire to fulfilling these rights? And Dr. Thurer, I think you can answer this to some extent based on your experience as Undersecretary General at the United Nations.
Well, I'm frankly worried about multilateralism. You know, this month is the 75th anniversary of the United Nations. On the 24th of October, they hit their 75th birthday. But instead of the pandemic bringing the world together, rallying behind international organizations as the institutions that provide succor and strength to deal with global challenges like this pandemic, what do we have? We have the US pulling out of the WHO. We have countries essentially talking about their sovereignties, throwing up their own barriers, resisting, reaffirming their sovereignties. There's this desperate competition to protect national interests. Everyone with money is trying to get a lock on the vaccines as they come out for their own people. You're talking about withdrawing companies and production chains from foreign lands back into your own, cutting off from supply chains of other countries, decoupling, for example, from the Chinese. All of these things suggest a retreat from what we've seen of globalization and of global cooperation. And my worry with this is obviously that if the institutions that we built up, the world built up at the end of the Second World War, are fatally weakened by the fact that that governments have derived this wrong lesson from the pandemic, that they need to be more self-reliant and less dependent on foreign countries, then I think the real worry we'll have is that those institutions will be very much less well-equipped to do what you want them to do, and that is to help respond to these problems, whether social, whether economic, whether geopolitical. And I think a weak international system means every country for itself, and that is going to create a sort of international law of the jungle, which we haven't seen since the Second World War. So I really do worry. I'm at this stage quite anxious about the future of multilateralism, which we've taken for granted now for 75 years since the end of the Second World War.
How can we continue to sort of tout these, the value of international institutions, when I think a lot of people, both in India and the United States, see the effects of globalization, of multinational corporations, as in many ways a negative impact on their domestic communities? I think, Dr. Winfield, you may have something to say on this point as well.
I mean, I think what we're facing now should be a wake-up call of how any type of security, be it of health, of our livelihoods, even military security, really depends upon the security of people in other nations. And we see that with regard to this pandemic, and it's going to be true of future pandemics. There's no way a country can wall itself off from the spread of an infection that originates elsewhere in the world, just because of the nature of globalization and our interdependencies of all sorts. And it's clear that, you know, if we are going to contain this or any future pandemic, we have to make use of international organizations like the World Health Organization. You know, we have to have a real international mobilization to be out looking for pathogens that are in wild species that are going to make the transition to human species. 75% of new diseases originate in that way. And because of climate change and changing human habitats and animal habitats, there's more contact now with pathogens we've never seen before. So there has to be an international effort to find where the next sources will be, and to begin testing, and to provide stockpiles available to every nation of everything they need to test, identify people, treat them and the like. And the other side of it, we have to have international mobilization of resources so that a nation can lock down if necessary and keep its people solvent, because they need support, they need financial support. And that's a key. We can't contain anything if all of these sides are not available. And then of course we have the advancing climate catastrophe breathing down all our necks. And that, you know, the United States, which is guilty of historically the greatest emissions of greenhouse gases, now is only emitting 15% of the world total. So even if we have a domestic Green New Deal, that is, I think we should shut down all new fossil fuel emissions by 2030, that's not going to solve our problem. And to do that, we need to have an international mobilization. So that a nation like India and China, for that matter, have the resources to expand their energy, but to do it cleanly. And that requires international resources, and it's going to benefit all nations immensely, given all the catastrophic effects we're facing.
I agree with what you've said, and I might add that one startling figure that's emerged recently is that the the pandemic has cost the world something like 305 million full-time jobs this year, according to the ILO, no less, the International Labour Organization, and that the fall in consumption is estimated in the trillions. 3.8 trillion is one figure. The loss of wages and salaries in the world, 2.1 trillion. We are facing a global catastrophe. Richard, I have to move on to the rest of my agenda for the evening. So I will have to leave you. But I'm very curious about something about your candidacy. What prompted the professor and academic, a teacher of logic, metaphysics, and Hegel, to jump into politics? I had a...
Robert Thoreau, if you can hear us, I think we're you've frozen on your end.
What facilitated this opportunity? I felt we were really facing a growing crisis in which the very future of our democracy was at risk, as well as our lives and livelihoods in face of this pandemic and economic crisis. And, you know, we have a system here of primaries where anyone can choose to stand up for election. I don't have to worry about a party bureaucracy to tell me whether or not I can run. And I can get out there. And in this race for the Senate, I was hoping that it would draw national press attention. And I would not be facing gerrymandering, which in the United States involves this very partisan districting, because I have the whole population of the state. So I would have a chance of getting a message out to more people than had heard it before, even if my chances of election were very remote. But I thought it would be worth the effort. So I decided, why not? I'll launch myself into this effort, since we really are in a crisis, and see where I go. And if I hadn't, I wouldn't be speaking to you at this event and have the audience we're garnering, or other such venues. So at a minimum, it offers opportunities that are not there otherwise.
Well, I really wish you luck getting the message out, getting the vote, and at the same time, improving, I think, the quality of the discourse. I don't think that politics often benefits from the kind of enriching set of ideas and reflections that you have brought into this. And I really congratulate you for doing that. I wish I could see more of this in my own country. We do have cerebral politicians. They're not too many. I think when my audio disappeared, I was in the process of saying that I head the All India Professionals Congress in India, and it's been a revelation how few professionals in India are even willing to dip their feet into the murky waters of politics. There is a sense that this is not a world for them. And in the US, I hope there still is a certain idealism associated with politics as a process of creating a better world and of generating the ideas and at the same time, the political traction for those ideas that will create a better America. And I wish you luck, Richard, in getting those ideas across to as large a section of the public as you can.
Well, thank you. And we'll see where we go. It's now a matter of life and death that this enterprise be undertaken.
So good luck.
Good luck in your own efforts in the world's largest democracy.
Thank you. We need it. And as we say, namaste to you and all the very best. Thank you, Karan, for your stewardship. I think the two of you are likely to continue, but I will leave you here. All the best. Right. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Thoreau.
Thanks. Thank you.
All right. Dr. Winfield, just you and I now.
Okay.
I think Dr. Thoreau mentioned a lot of interesting concepts, the discussion of multilateralism, the discussion of how COVID has affected the United States, and so on. I want to move back to the multilateralism question a little bit and talk a bit about the role of China and the World Health Organization and how much we can sort of leverage these multilateral institutions. That being said, earlier this year, the World Health Organization was unwilling to sort of recognize the success of Taiwan in responding to the COVID-19 pandemic. And if that's something that happens, can we, you know, ethically sort of count on the United Nations to direct human rights policy and be the standard to which we aspire?
Well, look, the problem with any kind of international organization, be it the League of Nations or the United Nations, is that the nations of the world are not going to willingly enter it. And of course, they can always withdraw so long as we acknowledge the sovereignty of a plurality of nations. they're not going to willingly enter unless the terms of the agreement are ones that pose restrictions on interference in their domestic affairs. And that's simply a reality of world organizations. Nonetheless, world organizations can mobilize international resources in a way that can be meaningful. Obviously, it can always be frustrated by individual nations who just simply refuse to comply. As Shashi Tharoor has pointed out, the United Nations was set up after the Second World War in a way in which the Security Council had permanent members who at that time represented, to some degree, the fading empires, the fading colonial empires of France, of Britain, and so forth, and gave nations whose real importance, one might say, or significance, has very much diminished. So that now we have a world in which the giants in the making, India and China, Indonesia, Brazil, are not permanent members of the Security Council. And I think we really need to think of reforming the United Nations so that it will have a certain type of authority in which there's some respect in a more democratic manner, right, representation of nations. And that, I think, could give it more scope and more authority. But I think, obviously, any international organization, the World Health Organization included, can be led in a way that is not as good as it should be. And but I think it is a mistake to withdraw from the World Health Organization, as the Trump administration has done. We really need to have international mobilizations of health resources, testing, research on vaccines and so forth, because this is a global problem and it cannot be solved domestically. Domestic things have to be taken, of course, measures, but you also need to have international resources. Now, it's possible to have taken the route of Taiwan, of Singapore, of Hong Kong, of New Zealand, of Australia, of Greece, of Uruguay, you know, nations which managed to really contain the pandemic early on, and even China, because China did succeed in containing the pandemic, despite the fact that their population, like India's, is about 4 to 5 times ours. They have a tiny fraction of the number of cases or deaths that we have suffered. And they've managed now to completely reopen their economy. They're up and running. They succeeded in containing it, whereas we have failed. And I think it's completely stupid to blame China for originating this, because look, a pandemic is going to originate somewhere or other. It doesn't originate because anyone has tried to create a pathogen that's going to decimate their own people. In this case, it's pretty evident that it happened through a transfer of a pathogen from wild animals to humans. And that's going to increase with global warming. Well, once it happens, then what? It spread. I mean, to begin with, the Chinese were local authorities, as we know, were trying to muzzle one of their leading medical scientists who was trying to blow the alarm on it. They silenced him, but eventually they recognized that they couldn't keep it silent. They allowed the DNA code of the virus to be delivered to the world, and they took very stringent measures. And we failed to do that, and we're paying the consequences.
I think something we can all notice in this discussion is that the issue of globalization and unemployment is inherently intersectional, right? It sort of depends on climate change. It depends on numerous other issues that may not directly fall within the narrow scope of globalization and unemployment. So with things like the Green New Deal or climate change, to what extent can we leverage these ancillary or other ideas towards actually addressing issues like unemployment? And how can we convince the people that these ideas are related?
Yeah. Now, first of all, I think there is an intrinsic connection to globalization and unemployment. Because globalization has different phases. We have a situation where somewhere or other, a nation began reinventing itself as what we call a modern society, in which traditional institutions were overthrown, an economy emerged, a demarcated household separate from the economic sphere emerged, and a political sphere separate from both emerged. And then this led to a dynamic of an economic system which could not help but be engaged in a continual effort to expand its wealth as something dictated by the very conditions of competition. And market relations are universal in scope. They don't respect national boundaries because they have a need to expand wealth because of the dynamics of competition, find new markets, expand production everywhere they can. So in a sense, this first modernized nation then infects the rest of the world. Some nations, like Japan, managed to avoid domination by a forced modernization from without by deciding to modernize themselves, as they successfully did. Other nations become subject to colonialization and imperialism. Well, the world has reached a point where decolonization has occurred. Most traditional forms of life have largely been uprooted, although you know there still is a significant dimension of such forms of life in certain parts of the world. But basically, we're now dealing with a world economy that is a world economy dominated by market relations and competition. And competition automatically involves unemployment because firms are always going in and out of business. They continually have to revolutionize their production and marketing. And that means that people are going to lose employment. And another side of globalization is that it, in a sense, increases the what I think is a kind of imbalance of economic opportunity and economic power within market relations. And that's the relation between employee and employer. You know, there's this fantasy that everyone can be an entrepreneur. You see it in these notions of, in South Asia, the idea of microloans as being a way of providing economic security, or land reform even. But the market does not allow everyone to be an entrepreneur. Firms must grow and expand and consolidate to stay solvent, which means in every market economy, eventually we have a large mass of employees, a much smaller group of employers, and that becomes a fundamental relationship on which the economy operates. But that also involves an imbalance because the opportunities of employers are much greater than those of employees. Globalization under the regime of free trade allows firms to move their operations anywhere in the world to take advantage of lower wages, lower costs of production, escape all sorts of environmental protections and the like. It can unleash a race to the bottom. And it makes it much more difficult for employees to protect their common interests, because a firm that faces a strong union movement can move its operations elsewhere. Now, of course, things like outsourcing, you know, are not bad for everyone. You know, a nation to which things are outsourced gains new employment, and the employment may be at a much higher wage than has already been operative. But, you know, we're now facing another dynamic, and that is the way in which employers throughout the world are taking advantage of a gig economy, where things can be outsourced anywhere 24/7 and done in a way where those who depend upon the gig economy do not have fixed hours, do not have guaranteed hours, do not have benefits, are completely isolated. And it increases this imbalance between the power of corporations and employees. Now, international agreements could attempt to rectify this imbalance, just as we have domestic legislation that tries to make it mandatory that corporations do the right thing. Mm-hmm. And when you make it mandatory domestically, at least within the home market, no firm is at a disadvantage in paying a fair minimum wage, in having certain safe standards, because they all have to comply. Internationally, that can be a problem, because you can shift your relations to other places which don't have to comply with these regulations. So that's why, in a sense, it's important to see if one can have international regulations as much as possible. I mean, all trade agreements should attempt, I think, to ensure that employers around the world are meeting certain basic standards, and also try to push the idea of full employment as a condition for trade. And that requires a certain public commitment. India is making it in a limited way, but on a large scale, in this program, which gives 100 days of guaranteed employment to rural population. We need something broader, of course. These have to be funded, and the wealthier nations can help fund them.
In a period where we see rising sort of protectionism and isolationism, and I think to some extent it's founded, right? Because there's a general negative sentiment towards the effects of globalization. And we see this among, blue-collar Americans. We see this in India. We see this across the world. How do we really convince people, though, that international agreements are where the answer lies, and the answer isn't in, tariffs and quotas and just an isolationism from the international community?
Well, look, I think tariffs and quotas can be used successfully by nations. I mean, for example, the United States, when it was on the verge of becoming a great industrial power and became the largest industrial power in 1871, it had to protect itself from what was then the dominant power in the world, economically speaking, which was Great Britain. And we had tariffs that protected American industry. You know, India attempted to do certain things of that sort on its own after independence. Many nations have attempted to do that. And I think in a way that can be used successfully, provided you do it in a way that does not prevent you taking advantage of international capital. I mean, after all, there are reasons for certain industries to be protected. On the other hand, the kind of tariffs that Trump has imposed on certain kinds of goods from China and the like, they're not tariffs that are going to allow for an emergence of an American industry that has long since disappeared. Because, I mean, we've seen what has it led to. The only thing it's led to is we pay higher prices on goods coming from China. And some manufacturers are moving from China to places like Vietnam and other low-wage producing areas, not to the United States. And American corporations are not investing in manufacturing because they know they're not going to be competitive under current conditions. So I think one has to work in a way where if one does involve quotas and tariffs, it has to be done in a multilateral way, in a way that can benefit all of the nations that are party to the agreement. So we don't have punitive barriers being erected that are not going to really benefit anyone, frankly.
Could you talk a little bit about your social Bill of Rights and the federal jobs guarantee and how you think the protection of these sort of labor rights through this this structure will counter the negative effects of globalization and unemployment, counter any sort of negative effects of multinational corporations?
Well, look, obviously, the United States has seen a decline in manufacturing employment. Now, actually, the amount of goods produced has not really declined that much, but the number of people working in those industries has plummeted. Now, only 8% of our breadwinners work in manufacturing, as I mentioned, 1.7% in agriculture. Right. These fields have been all highly mechanized. About 15% of American manufacturing jobs have been lost to outsourcing, but 85% have been lost to automation. That is really the key element. But there is an abiding problem of unemployment. And we can eliminate the scourge of unemployment. It is something that the market left to its own designs cannot eliminate. It's built into market relations insofar as firms do not all succeed. They have to transform themselves to remain competitive, which involves letting go workers, hiring workers with different skills, et cetera. So there's a degree of unemployment that is always there, and economies have a cyclical character because of the uneven pace of investment, because you have to make these capital investments that are going to be lasting for a certain period of time. And that involves sort of surges in investment and then retreats from that surge that lead to cycles of various kinds, which means we have fluctuating employment levels. Well, having a guaranteed job is the rock bottom of economic security. Because even if you are among the lucky few, if you want to speak in those terms, who either have the wealth or the credit to try or go as an entrepreneur or a landlord, if you fail, you're left with what we all have, ownership of our capacity to labor. But you have to have an employer for that to be a basis of any kind of economic independence. So that's what the job guarantee would do. It will ensure that we get rid of the scourge of unemployment, which affects our health, which is contagious, because when we have the unemployed, they have no money to spend. Businesses can't do well in that kind of environment. Unemployment increases. It's also a key to having such a thing as a school to prison pipeline or mass incarceration, or the spectacle of veterans coming back from work and ending up homeless, back from war and being homeless because they don't have a job awaiting them. But if we have a guaranteed job, we really overcome a lot of the social pathologies. And the other thing is it's a key to improving the situation of we who have jobs, because we no longer face the fear of firing. And in America, that fear is more severe than other places for several reasons. First, you know, we don't have a guaranteed job awaiting us, so we'll lose our income. But in America, crucial benefits are tied to employment. Many people have healthcare only through their work. And if they lose their job, it's a matter of life and death for them and their family members. And then in addition, we have the lowest rate of unionization in the world. More Americans face being fired at will than at any other country, any other democratic country. So for all these respects, people with power on the job can do such things as harass people sexually, act in a discriminatory way, engage in all sorts of abuses with impunity because people are terrified of losing their job. Having a federal job guarantee would transform that dynamic and put employees in a much better situation to be able to stand up for their rights. So I think it's a transformative measure. It also plays a key role in being able to proceed with a proper healthcare system, which I think Medicare for All in the context of America is the way to go. Because unlike Obamacare, it offers the same care to everyone. Everyone is covered. No one has copays, deductibles, or premiums to pay. You have the freedom to go to any healthcare practitioner. We get rid of all the bloated overhead of for-profit health insurance plans. We can negotiate in strength as one to reduce our healthcare costs to those of other nations and save $1.7 trillion. But also we have to recognize people in the private health insurance industry are going to lose their jobs because no one will want to use it because Medicare is so superior, Medicare for all. Well, with a federal job guarantee, they will have jobs. Same thing applies to a Green New Deal. If we are going to be putting out of business the fossil fuel industry, a federal job guarantee will ensure that all those people, who are not that many, frankly, because all of these industries are highly automated and becoming more and more mechanized, they will have a job awaiting them at a fair wage. And this also applies to really eliminating racial and gender disadvantage, because it wipes out the higher levels of unemployment and poverty income among minorities and among women, and really provides a basis for true reproductive freedom. Because that also involves being able to have the children you want, which you can't have if you don't have a livelihood.
Right. As we sort of approach the end of the event, we're about 7 minutes away from 9:30. I want you to talk a little bit more about your campaign and how the policies you aspire to fit within the context of the current Democratic administration and the structure that the Biden campaign has put forth. Are there policies you want to see changed or expanded upon? Are there priorities that you have one over the other? Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah. Well, the policies I'm putting forward are closer to the policies that Bernie Sanders was advocating, and to a large degree that Elizabeth Warren were advocating. You know, as we know that when Biden triumphed in the primaries, he did adopt to some degree part of the platforms of these candidates, which means he, for example, is speaking about having a transition to clean energy by 2035. I'm saying 2030. He's not willing to offer a federal job guarantee that Bernie Sanders finally had adopted. But he speaks about obviously having job creation. He doesn't speak about Medicare for all. He wants to strengthen Obamacare, which I think is not the proper way to go because of the inherent problems in Obamacare. But I think we face, as citizens, the opportunity, if we can elect Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, to try to push them further to adopt this full social rights agenda. And I think Biden will be less likely to veto Medicare for All or a federal job guarantee. I think a Republican administration is dead set against all of these measures. So I think although I'm disappointed with how the primary went, and I'm not that enthusiastic about how both Biden and Kamala are running their campaigns and essentially stressing how they're not going to be for such things as a Green New Deal and not speaking about employment in a way that I think would be transformative, because we are in a perfect storm. I mean, people are facing economic distress in a way they haven't, at least some people, many people, that is time for these programs to really be put forward before the public. Now, in general, there's also the whole problem of how our political system operates. I mean, Shashi Tharoor was speaking about the difficulty of having meaningful political discussion. Well, I, from my experience on the campaign trail, first of all, the only candidates who can be sure of getting their existence and message known to the public are those who are awash with millions of dollars, and in a Senate race, tens of millions of dollars, which I am not. But alas, the only kind of message they get to the public is a soundbite in a TV ad. And the press is failing in its democratic duty to have any meaningful coverage of all the candidates and what they stand for and discuss their different platforms. None of that is taking place. So it's a situation where even if voters can overcome voter suppression, their right to vote is very empty because they cannot be meaningfully informed about who they're voting for to any large degree. I mean, we have a presidential debate or two, but we know how limited those have been and usually are as discussions. You know, we need to have a campaign system that provides proper public subsidies so every voter is properly informed about what their choices are, and that's not the case. And it's also difficult to run for office if you are an employee, because even though we all supposedly have the right to run for office, if you're in a race for Senate or Congress or any other serious race, it's a full-time activity. You have to give up your job. You have no income during the duration of the campaign. In America, you don't have crucial benefits like healthcare, and you can't expect your job to be waiting for you at the end of the campaign. I'm lucky because I'm a tenured professor. I can return to teaching at UGA next January if I lose. But most people can't, and you can see who is it who represents us in Congress. There are not many employees, let alone union members. On average, they're millionaires. They're independently wealthy. They're professionals who can carry on earning money during a campaign and go back to their profession later on, but not what 95% of the rest of us end up doing. So I think these are problems one faces, and you see it on the campaign trail. Very.
All right. Well, Richard, we've got about 2 minutes left. Do you have any sort of final words for the people of Georgia, the people of the United States, you know, all our viewers on Zoom and Facebook?
Well, I think one should think about the topic of this discussion today, of the way in which, you know, we are in a globalized world, and the economic problems we're facing, the health problems we're facing, the global climate crisis we're facing, and the attendant challenges to our democracy are all matters that require action both domestically and internationally. And we have to recognize that. You know, we cannot deal with the pandemic by shutting us off from the world. We have to be proactive and support international institutions. That's obviously the case with climate change. You know, it's not going to help us if we do things in this nation and things are not being done elsewhere. We have to really mobilize ourselves internationally. And also with regard to economic problems in general, these are matters that require international cooperation. And, you know, we need to think about that clearly. And one thing we didn't discuss are the issues of nuclear weapons, you know, which have sort of fallen into the background with everything else that is going on. But they recognize that they represent still a significant threat to the very existence of humanity. And that requires international cooperation. We should not be militarizing space, as Trump seems intent on doing. We should not be reducing our commitments to control of nuclear weapons. We want to tackle the problem of nuclear proliferation and drastically reduce nuclear weapon arsenals. Ours and Russia are ridiculously immense compared to those of any other nation. And any significant nuclear exchange threatens to wipe out humanity with nuclear winter, destruction of the ozone layer, as well as the incineration of all of our cities. So these are all matters that I think all of us have to take seriously, whether we're citizens of the United States or citizens of India.
All right, well, Dr. Winfield, thank you so much for your discussion and coming here today. I wanna thank all the audience members on Facebook and on Zoom for tuning in and listening to our conversation. You can find more about Richard's campaign and his platform on winfieldforsenate.com or on all of his social media platforms as well. Richard, I hope to continue speaking in the future, and everyone make sure to be as educated as possible on current politics and vote.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for leading this discussion.
Absolutely.